Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about, you guessed it, board games. I'm here with my co-host and dear friend, Mark. How are you this week, Mark?
I'm quite well, thanks, except for the fact that somebody stole my green bin.
God, what's the world coming to?
I don't know where it is.
When even your green bin is no longer sacred.
We engage in municipal composting here in Kingston. I'm quite a convert to it. It is great, albeit occasionally smelly. And now my green bin is gone. I have to go pick up a new one. And you know what I'm concerned about? I'm concerned that they're going to try to saddle me with one of those small 40-liter bins. I need the full 80-liter bin.
Inadequate green bin.
So we're going to talk about board games this week. We're going to talk about the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intersegment, the Eurus, what we reviewed last year. We're going to talk about the games we played last week, the news, and why it doesn't matter. And then our topic, which is looks fighty but isn't.
Sheep in wolves' clothing.
Butter not gun. A sword and a lot of plowshares.
Just so. And those that are looking for a video version of this, there is none this week. Just so you know.
So, Walker, what did we review last year?
We reviewed a game called Darwin's Journey, which I have kept and want to keep. The production is fantastic. The whole look of it. The, you know, sort of old-time scientific drawing type style.
Journal style, yeah.
Journal style. The gameplay is also very interesting. I enjoy playing it. It's also on Board Game Arena. I've been playing it a lot there. Everything about Darwin's Journey, I am enjoying.
Darwin's Journey is great. I'm a fan. You're right. The production is marvelous. It's by Thundergriff Games, and they tend to go all out on a lot of their productions, and usually in a functional way, and so I very much appreciate their attitude towards components, with the possible exception that, you know, a few more minimalist publishers would be good in the board game space, but that having been said. It is not my favorite of the Italian Masters Euro games, though. You know, it's Simone Luciani and Nestore Mangione, and there's a lot of different Luciani games to play. And frankly, I think Barrage is still the best of that category. And Darwin's Journey is good, but I don't think it's quite as good as their best work. This is, of course, not a tremendous condemnation, because I have yet to play a Simone Luciani game or any of the games of the Italian Masters, really, and be like, oh, well, that's not worth my time.
And there's going to be another crowdfunding starting early 2025, which will have a large expansion, which will have a ton of different modules, one of which is the Komodo Dragon. Is that?
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. An entire expansion just for one creature?
Well, I think it's like one of the little mini modules. It'll probably be just like a, you know, I'm not, no idea what it's going to entail.
Oh,
now I'm disappointed. But there is a Komodo Dragon.
I wanted a version of Darwin's Journey where it's like, okay, so here's a whole bunch of finches. Here's a whole bunch of different barnacles. Yeah, yeah, fine. Because apparently Darwin was big into barnacles largely on a dare. My understanding is that more or less he said, look, I've done this whole thing with finches. I could do a full taxonomy of any type of creature you wanted just to prove my theory. Because at that point there wasn't a whole lot of data. And so I was like, yeah, yeah, do barnacles. And there's a billion different kinds of barnacles. And by the end of it, Darwin said, no man hates the barnacle as much as I do. Anyway, and, you know, all the other things, the normal grid. And then I wanted just a separate board just for Komodo Dragons. And you're telling me I can't do that?
We'll see.
That's too bad. Oh, well.
That is the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago.
Now, one of the games we played last week, we got to play Iron Forest. So, as we've commented a number of times before on the show, four players is not a player count we have very often. We, in point of fact, have six players more often than we have four, broadly speaking. And my biggest complaint about Iron Forest thus far is that it is a fixed four-player game. We tried it once with three, with the free-for-all rules, which were fine, but not, I think, at its best. In no small part because it doesn't then let you play with the pre-designed scenarios, and it doesn't let you play with the team-based system, and the activation system is different. And anyway, it very much seems like the mode to allow people to play the game suboptimally.
Well, I don't know. I kind of like, when we're thinking about it, I kind of like the three-player better, because all the things you had to do were different. You know, the sort of quests that you're going on changed up considerably, whereas in our four-player game, it was mostly just the same thing.
Well, okay. For context, though, so now I've played two scenarios multiplayer. Once with two-player, I played with a Lupo, and then we played the four-player version. And it's the scenarios that vary the different objectives. So the free-for-all version is kind of like a mashup of all the different kinds of things you do in scenarios. So yes, within a single scenario, you'll be largely doing the same kind of thing. Though, I did appreciate the asymmetry. So in the scenario we played scenario two, and one team just had to go through gates, and another team had to go through gates keyed off of specific numbers that their mech had been assigned. So, for example, one team was like, okay, here's 8 gates on the board. Go through them all in any order. And when you go through a gate, you get the token. And
with dice?
No, some with dice, some without, but you can set that aside. And then the other team had specific dice assigned to them, and then there were numbered gates on the board. So this mech had to hit gate 2 and gate 4 in either order. This mech had to hit gate 3 and gate 4 in any order. And that asymmetry I thought was really cool. And it, not only did I enjoy it in the context of the team asymmetry, it makes me more enthusiastic to see what the other scenarios look like.
I like the fact that you can now damage other mechs as well.
Right.
That was interesting.
Yeah, that part too. There's this issue of power-up cards that you get in Iron Forest, where if you hit mechs, not only does it cause them to go back to the starting area, you don't skip a turn, but it's like the satisfying version of skip a turn.
Yeah.
You have to redeploy in your starting area, but you still get normal activations. And you get these power-up cards, which get to do fun, cool things, and so it makes it feel like it's a big smackdown. The biggest thing, though, about Iron Forest, and I've been talking about this ever since we started playing Iron Forest, is that the engineering is really, really, really well done. The pieces are all supremely well done. The boards are well done. The mechs are well done. The tokens are well done. The gates are well done. The one thing that people do not believe me, though, and I'm going to if you have any suggestions about how to improve this, it's better. I say, this is the launcher. Take some test shots with the launcher if you want to, because the launcher will send your mech up to the second level. First of all, people have not been taking test shots. And then secondly, I tell them, trust the launcher. The launcher will not cause you to overshoot. It might, theoretically, if you really tried to, but put it at maximum extension. The problem is that every hobbyist gamer I've told this to has had experiences with other launchers, and they put it, like, I keep telling them, no, further, 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 and they bring it to, like, 75%,
yeah.
And then the mech doesn't get to the second level.
Because it is a fairly long pull down.
It is.
And you think it's going to, like, hit the ceiling.
Yeah, you do.
But trust the launcher, Mark.
You've got to trust the launcher.
Trust the launcher.
People don't trust the launcher, and they need to trust the launcher. I'm having a blast with Iron Forest. I think it's great. This is exactly the kind of hobbyist product that speaks to Mark. It's got various trappings of miniatures games. It's got various trappings of other strategy games, although it's not a hybrid by any stretch of the imagination. It is just a dexterity smackdown thing. But it's elaborated enough that the scenario design gets to be interesting and the different powers get to be interesting. And it's just visually impressive and tactilely satisfying. This is what I love about dexterity games. This might be right up there with Crash Octopus as like my all-time favorites.
True. It sort of made me define what I enjoy about flicking games and sort of made me put it into two sort of categories. There's like, I don't want to say gimmicky because that is sort of a negative context, but
sure.
There's like the gimmick.
Toyetic. What about toyetic?
Toyetic, maybe. And so that's like our Flick Fleet, our Ice Cool, or Iron Forest. And then there's just the straight up flicking a flat disc on a flat surface, SEAL Team Flicks, Catacombs, that type of
thing. I see. You want to put SEAL Team Flicks as like a more straightforward thing.
I do.
In terms of the actual, well, okay, sometimes that's true in terms of the actual flicking, but then you get into circumstances like, would you include all the sideboard mini games in that category as well? Like the,
yeah, because it is a flat disc on a flat surface.
Sure, okay, well, but what about when you're shooting a shotgun through a door? Just because it's a flat disc on a flat surface, anything there?
In my head.
Okay, well, in my head, SEAL Team Flicks is in the hybrid category. I have a special love for the hybrid category. I would also put Flick Fleet into the hybrid category. But in terms of like pure dexterity, pretty much all you're just doing is flicking things around. There's not really, you don't really manage, well, there's a little bit of hand management, I guess. I guess what I'm saying is that my taxonomy is incredibly fragile and apt to be shifted based on how long I talk about it. So it's about as consistent as I ever
am. It's mostly like in Flick Fleet and or Ice Cool and or Iron Forest, there is a sort of a curling aspect to both. There is a way to flick a die or flick acrylic things that it's going to coast to one side or not, where with discs, there's not much play like that. There is a little bit, but not much.
I hear you. Yeah, the possibility of trick shots.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that is definitely something, and that is one thing that I keep talking about in terms of Iron Forest and Ice Cool. And that is something that is so transparent. And this is something where people do trust my explanation. Like, look, here are some trick shots. They're not always going to work, but you can at least get started on them. And within like 3 flicks, oh yeah, look at that. And they're like curving around doors and stuff. It's great. Iron Forest is marvelous. If you're a hobbyist gamer that has enthusiasm for toys and dexterity games, I highly recommend you give it a shot. It is a very, very impressive offering by Brian Gomez and Brain Games. I also really stand by Ice Cool in its various iterations. We should try Ice Cool Wizards again. That, I think, is a better free-for-all than, well, qua free-for-all.
So, seeing as it is holiday season, we have people coming in from out of town.
I don't. I'm lucky.
Which means the return of some games that you... Unfortunately, Kabuto Sumo has yet to arrive, so who knows where that is.
Or manifest.
In any way.
See, look, here's the thing you need to understand, listeners. Walker is a very generous individual. Unfortunately, his generosity outstrips his memory. He has many games that are out on loan at various places, and he doesn't know where they are. So just a little peek behind the curtain for people who aren't commissioners, overlords, or apotheoses of swag. I tend to take the blame because I just want to be... I don't want a sandbag Walker, but if you've requested a game from the commissioner's list and I say, oh, well, there's been a bit of a clerical error, we can't lay our hands on it. Some of the time, that's because I messed up and I didn't maintain the list properly. Some of the time, that's because Walker lent it somewhere and has no earthly idea where the game is. Such is the story of SlideQuest.
But SlideQuest has returned. And we got to play it.
Yes.
And what a fantastic game. So it has these, I want to say, plastic levers that rest on the bottom of the box. Like, you empty the box out, put it in the middle of the table, four slots on the outside, you rest these levers, and the top of the box... No, sorry, it's not the top
plastic
of the box.
Tray.
A plastic tray nestles on top of these four levers. So four people are raising and lowering these levels, which sort of rocks this plastic tray around, on which a knight with a ball bearing in his base allows him to slide around this. And you put a plethora of different maps onto this thing that has all these pit holes in it, or gates, or rocks, or dynamite, or enemies. Need to push enemies into certain holes or into any pits. Need to not knock over the dynamite, get around the holes, go through the gates, get to the other side of the map. It is just a good time, and I'm sure any child will love this game, because I love this game.
A child of any age, I think, will love SlideQuest. We've played it with two. And when we played it with two a few years ago, we played it under the time limit variant, where suddenly it's extraordinarily difficult to play. I understand why you initially introduced it to us with the time limit variant. I prefer it without the time limit. It's hard enough. It is difficult enough even with actual gamers or child gamers without the time limit additional burden. The way I would analogize it is like those wooden mazes with little metal balls with the dials on the sides where you can tilt the maze in various ways. But this is a co-op board game version of that. And with four players, it is, I think, actually a little bit easier than with two. Because when you're playing with two players, it's a fixed four-player game. You don't play it with three. Solo wouldn't really work, I don't think. Maybe with some maps, I don't know. But with two players, you suddenly have to coordinate your left and right hands and understand what you're doing, and sometimes you need to coordinate with your hand, sometimes you're coordinating with someone else's hand.
Suddenly there's an emergency, and the wrong hand triggers.
Exactly. With four players, it's a little bit easier, although by no means easy. You just have to recognize, any time I want the knight to go north, I am in charge of north. And that makes it simpler, at least. And thus, we, you know, picked a random map, just kept going until we died. It was a grand old time.
That's SlideQuest, put out by Blue Orange Games, designed by Nicolas Bergeron and Jacques-François Rochas.
No, that would be Jean-François Rochas.
Rochas, sorry.
Played the Gang again. This is the co-op Texas Hold'em game by John Cooper and Corey Heath. Rest in peace. And I really am appreciating the core systems of the Gang, and I'm appreciating the variant cards less and less and less. I don't know if there are better ones. So the theory behind the Gang is you're playing Texas Hold'em, and at the end of the round, you all have to correctly rank all the players' hands in relation to each other. And that's difficult enough, especially when, as in the game we played, it was several versions of, well, I have Queen High with a six kicker. Well, I have Queen High with a five kicker, so your hand is better. That's already fine-grained enough, but once you start winning rounds and you get these modifier cards that say things like, on top of having to win by normal means, you additionally have to stipulate what the winning hand is, or you have to stipulate a specific value of a card in the winning hand. And frankly, I don't think the communicative tools that exist in the Gang are I think they're too coarse to really help you get that kind of level of detail.
I don't know, in our game, the whole table jumped to the right conclusion, and then another player talked them out
How
of it.
How dare you? That is not what happened. This is some Bigfoot-level revisionism going on right here. I will not be slandered on my own podcast.
I never said your name once. I didn't say it was you. I said a player.
This is slander and calumny. No, I just don't find them interesting, right? I find the core systems of the gang interesting, but what they do with it with the variant cards, I don't find... It doesn't lean into its strengths. Very often, like another modifier card, for example, is play one less round of communication. It's like, you made a cool game where you get to communicate in interesting ways. Don't then tell me I get to do less of it, right? I understand they need to make the rounds harder. They need to have some way to vary the difficulty. But if you compare the gang to, say, the crew, which is perhaps a fair comparison in some ways, an unfair comparison in other ways, I find the crew does a better job of moderating the difficulty and introducing interesting variants from round on round. So as it is, I wonder if the gang has a half-life in a way that the crew doesn't. That's my concern. You've seen far more of these cards than I have, though. Have you seen any where you saw it's like, ooh, that's really cool?
No, I like the one that you did not like. I like the one where you have to rate the rank of the person's hand exactly, whether it be two pair or okay. a flush or something. I really enjoy. I can see where it could go very badly depending on the flop that you got, but in all, I enjoy that hand, that particular card.
Fair enough. And I'm perfectly willing to play it. It's very quick. It's very satisfying. The communication is often unintentionally hilarious, where players are fighting over who think they've got the worst hand. And then it turns out, oh, Huey had a 6 and a 4. That's about as bad as you can get. Okay.
I guess he was right to fight for that one.
He was right to fight for that one, yeah. But as I say, I worry that it's going to get a little repetitive, especially when the variant cards I find pretty unsatisfying. But we'll see. We'll see. Time will tell. I'm sure you're going to be bringing it to the table a lot.
So we streamed a couple of games this Saturday. First one was Harmonies, and then we streamed Set a Watch. So Harmonies is getting a lot of buzz this year, and rightfully so. I really think it's sort of like a, I don't know, I was trying to put into words again today, sort of like a flag game. I think it's just one of those games that you can suggest to people because I think it's welcoming to all. I think it has a light enough rule set and generic enough that it will appeal to almost everyone. And it looks fantastic and plays in a short amount of time. So overall, you know, I would never pick it as, you know, my top 5 games, but I just think it's a very solid entry to this year.
Yeah, there's something very satisfying. I mean, the equivalent from last year, I think, would be Gnar, right?
Correct.
You can suggest it to almost anybody that can take lightweight hobby games. Which is not to say everyone generally, and again, no judgment on people who cannot process lightweight hobbyist games. It's, you know, processing rule sets is a skill that not everyone has, and it's not even a very valuable skill outside the context of playing hobbyist games. So no shade if that's not your bag. But I agree with you. It's visually pleasing. It's aesthetically pleasing in other ways as well. It's very approachable. The theme isn't really going to alienate anybody. I mean, maybe Gnar might have in some cases.
Yeah.
But
that's a fantastic comparison.
Yeah, yeah. And there's something just very, very satisfying at a game that hits that many bases.
Yeah, so very briefly, in case you haven't listened to me natter on about Harmonies 500 times.
And if so, I envy you.
Yeah, you are drafting these 3 discs that are creating biomes for these animal cards that you get to choose if you wish every round. And so you're creating all these biomes that you want interlocked. And while all that is going on, you're also trying to place these landmark tiles in ways that score at the end of the round, like longest river, groups of mountains, so on and so forth, in hopes to get the highest score.
My only criticism of Harmonies, and I agree with you, it's very pleasant, is part of me wishes that it was more focused on one or the other of the scoring mechanisms. Probably I would be happier if it focused more on the animal cards, because as it is, it ends up feeling a little less focused than I would have preferred. That's a minor criticism for an excellent offering.
All right, and that's Harmonies, put out by Liblid and designed by Johan Beldno. And like I said, Set a Watch was the other game we streamed. You can check out our YouTube live channel if you want to watch either of these. Set a Watch is a cooperative game where you roll and then manipulate and use dice to sort of triage this group of monsters that is flowing at you. A little bit like Xenoshift style, where you flip the location, it'll tell you how many monsters are going to come at you. And the Set a Watch title comes in where you have a fire level, and depending on how high your fire level is going to let you know how many of these monster cards you get to flip up and see at the beginning of the line. And so you're using the normal D&D character tropes, cleric, fighter, and we actually started the sort of campaign system for Set of Watch. So,
because Walker has many expansions.
Because, you know, yes. And I don't have enough campaigns on the go right now. I need another one. So each round, someone has to tend the fire. The other characters, this is the first time we've actually played it with four. So I was interested to see how that worked. Because every other time so far, I've either played it by myself or with three, where we just sort of rotated the character out who is going to tend the fire.
Yeah, actually, it on the topic of too many campaigns, we decided not to continue playing Dead Cells, the board game. And in some ways, there's some similarity between the structure of Set of Watch and Dead Cells, the board game, because if you play with four in Dead Cells, one player just doesn't participate in the combat. They just go do a single skill check. In the context of Set of Watch, it's not as punishing as that. One of the characters is expected to go tend the fire, and they get a little bit more to do than they would in Dead Cells, but they don't get quite as much to do as the people actually get to go do the fight. So how did it shake out?
I think it was fine. You know, we let them set up the creature deck, so they're in charge of manipulating the creatures for everybody
else. Oh, so they get
to
do all the chores.
That's right. They got to do the chores.
Tend the fire, shuffle the cards, massage my feet, and we'll let you know what's going
to
happen.
Just so. And every character has their own sort of campfire action they get to do, which is kind of interesting. You have five skills. Only three are going to be on your sheet, and they're also your hit points. So as you take damage, you lose these skills and camp actions that you sub them in. And so you're trying to get your best skills out and trying to use the three dice you have to get through that line of monsters. And I really enjoy Set of Watch.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was just a little bland. I mean, at the end of the day, it's pretty much just one die, one kill most of the time. I mean, it's a little straightforward. Like, I played as the cleric. I tend to play as clerics in fantasy adventure games. And, you know, my character had, you know, spend any die, kill any undead monster. I'm like, okay, well, I'll take my lowest die, and I'll kill the best undead that I can kill with it. Next. And I felt that all the processes were more or less at that level.
True. There is a little manipulation where some characters will let you flip cards up, so you want to get those off so the cleric can see more cards, so they can, you know what I mean? There's that sort of like manipulating the line. And
true.
Also,
I would have been happier if there was a little bit more manipulation like that. Like, for again, the comparison to Xenoshift, I actually found that despite the fact that there's no like heavy player asymmetry, there was a lot more dynamism in the play of Xenoshift because everybody has their soldiers with their special abilities and trying to puzzle out how to get through this independently of then lording on a whole bunch of equipments and one-shots that you get to play around with. Anyway.
True, and like
very different games, but structurally similar.
And like Xenoshift, there's a lot of reveal. So when you do flip up these creatures, they usually have this nasty thing that happens when they're revealed, and sort of trying to deal with that is sometimes kind of
fun. Like maybe the category was executive realness, but instead what they're serving is fresh fish. A disastrous reveal.
It's awful.
Yeah.
So that's Set of Watch, designed by Mike Gannad and Todd Walsh, put out by Rock Manor Games.
Finally got to play Endeavor Age of Expansion. This is an expansion to Endeavor that I have been sitting on for quite some time. This is by Burnt Island Games, another company not entirely unlike Thundergriff that reliably puts out a very, very visually and tactile impressive product. In this case, it is full of manageable, but nonetheless Kickstarter excess. So like the first player marker is this very large plastic crown. The fortification markers are cardboard in the retail edition, but in the Kickstarter version, and keep in mind, fortifications will hardly ever come up, but they're these special wood tokens now, and just special plastic pieces for pirate ships that almost never mat. Anyway, it's a whole thing. So this is a redevelopment of a game that was originally published in 2009, designed by Jarrett Gray. And I remember playing it in the original version in 2009. This was just when tracks were starting to become omnipresent. But Endeavor is a very simple track-based game. The tracks determine like how many advantage cards you're able to have out, the level of building you get to build. I appreciate how streamlined everything is. Like, the way you build a building is there's a phase in the turn when you build buildings. How do you build a building? Well, you choose a building that is at your building level or lower. What's the cost? Ain't no cost. Build the building. And it also serves as the round tracker. Seven rounds, seven buildings to build. That's it. That's where you're going. And so that's just an indication of how tight and streamlined everything is. As I've commented before, particularly last week, Euros are a lot more involved as a rule now than they used to be. Like, Endeavor used to be regarded as a midweight Euro game. Now it's definitely light medium at best. And I just appreciate the way it does things. I also appreciated some of the design changes between Endeavor and Endeavor Age of Sail, which is the Burnt Island edition. For one thing, card acquisition became a lot more dynamic. In the original version, Walker, since I don't think you know this, in the original version of Endeavor, you could not acquire cards until the region was opened.
Oh.
So that was very different in terms of the overall tempo of the game.
And there's a new version out now as well, which I think is more a modern version that I'm looking forward to trying. It's that Endeavor Deep Sea.
Yeah, yeah. This is the traditional method. Normally, you start with sci-fi and then you go to Deep Sea. Endeavor has bypassed that. They've done colonialism and now they're going to Deep Sea. Endeavor, for what it's worth, it's worth mentioning, also seeks to grapple with issues of colonialism and slavery slightly more than Euros of its time. The degree to which it's successful is debatable, but at least their hearts were in the right place and they were trying to do something with it. And that dynamic did matter in our particular game. And I very much appreciate being able to try the expansion. The expansion introduces a whole new set of buildings, so the rules load is minimal. It's just, here are the buildings available to build. And one thing that I completely didn't know, and I felt like a complete maroon for not having realized it sooner, is that the base game buildings are just on the other side of the expansion buildings, so I'd been carrying around the expansion box like a silly person. I didn't need to. It's all there, Walker. It's all there.
It's all there.
It's all there. Trust the launcher, Walker.
Yeah. Like you said, I love the tracks. I love the tracks because they're all equally important. Like, one gets you the discs that you need for this round. One, you know, will let you clear the action slots because you have to put the discs on the action slots to activate the actions. But if they're not clear mark, you can't use them.
No, you can't.
So another track tells you how many you get to clear off. Another one, it's just so many tracks, but all equally important. So there's not one that you want to go up. One is for the level of building that you're allowed to choose. And like you said, it's great that it's free. You don't have to worry about, you know, manipulating money for that. And then you're just fighting over different areas. You're trying to get the most influence there so you can get the bigger cards, so you can score the points at the end of the game. Lots to like about Endeavor.
Yeah, I should definitely bring it around more often. It's got these modules in the Kickstarter version that are... We tried them once a few years ago, and I was left feeling unimpressed. They struck me as the kind of thing that was, number one, both spatially and conceptually over there and thus easy to ignore. And number two, I felt that they considerably muddied up what is a very clean, straightforward, and engaging design. But nonetheless, they're there, and I don't know, I'm somewhat curious. They definitely introduce a lot of variety into the formula, not that I regard the game as repetitive in any way, but I'm curious to see if there's anything interesting in there, because a lot of work went into it clearly, and I'd like to give Endeavor more chances to hit the table. So that was Endeavor, in particular, Endeavor Age of Expansion, which you gotta say is an obvious title for the expansion to a colonial-themed game. Designed by Jarrett Gray, published by Burnt Island Games, the expansion came out in 2020.
Got to show Mark Windmill Valley, finally. This is designed by Danny Garcia, same designer of Barcelona.
Oh, I completely forgot this was by Danny Garcia. Sure.
And put out by Board and Dice Games. And long story short, you're planting, you're collecting tulips, you're planting tulips, you're sort of racing to upgrade your gears, because upgraded gears give you better, more powerful actions. Not only that, you want assistant farmers, because they also, you know, trigger off of different actions you're doing. So a race to quickly improve your tableau while trying to fill your tulip board.
Yeah, it's one of those rondel, upgrade your rondel kind of things, which is always pleasing. I was struck by how little the windmills mattered. This is a very minor point. You know, you call the game Windmill Valley. It was mostly about the tulips, which is fine.
Well, not only that, right? Because we talked about this multiple, like, do you not see how egregiously large that board is?
Yeah.
In which you put out windmills, which you not really do, because it is a action that you can do, but not very often. And yes, it's such just a waste of space.
Do you know who I wish had published this game? Devere.
Yes.
I think Devere would have done a marvelous job with Windmill Valley, because all you really need are a couple of tracks, a couple of spaces for cards, and then a space to drop your windmills, which, doesn't, as you say, don't need to be that big at all. So, yes, I think this could have been a much more minimalistic affair. Also, as well, in terms of minimalism, I think that Windmill Valley was a very satisfying Euro, but it was a full 90 minutes, maybe even a little bit longer, with three players. And that is probably longer than I would have liked it to have been. I think that, shaving off a round or two, finding a way to make the scoring a little bit more tight would have been satisfying, because you're building most of the points you're going to get. In many instances, are going to be coming from the tulips that you're planting. And the tulips, they have to be planted this is very thematically engaging for what it's worth. They have to be planted in rows of light color, but in alternating color. So look, this row has to be all white, but next to it, you can't put another white row next to that. No. Nor could you put a red flower in the middle of the white row. That's disgusting.
Madness.
I will burn that to the ground, and not a jury in the world will convict me I'm tried in Holland.
We will salt the hell out of that field.
Yeah.
Nothing will grow.
Absolutely. So you're trying to manage the various colors and getting all the... First, you got to get the bulbs, and then you got to plant the bulbs. It's not particularly convoluted. It's very satisfying in that way. But so most of the action is about the bulbs and the tulips you're going to be planting. And again, in terms of the sheer weight of components involved, you're just managing these small cardboard tokens on your own personal board, as opposed to this large sprawling board where all the windmills go, and you're going to be spending far more time on the flowers than with the windmills, and they're far more consequential. So it's just a little bit weird. So if they had made the grid of tulips a little bit smaller, shaved off a round or two, what can you say? That probably would have been my preference. Because as it is, this is one of those things where I'm not sure that experience with the game is going to shave off a lot of time, because the better you are, the more you're going to be able to trigger combos. It's not especially combo-tastic, but it's a little combo-tastic.
I can almost say it's... I was thinking while you're talking, it's like a...
You weren't listening to what I was saying, of course.
When do I ever?
Right.
So it's like a Kaput Rigny Light. Because it's very similar. Because
that's a good
there's
point.
There's rotating gears that will give you options of two actions, mm-hmm. and you sort of manipulate stuff around. So it's like a lighter version of Regnus Kaput Regni.
Praga Kaput Regni.
Yes, thank you.
Prague, capital of the world. No, I agree. That's a pretty accurate description. And I do find it more satisfying, and if in no small part, because the scoring is more focused. It's primarily about planting these flowers. Yeah, there are bonus cards that... many of which relate to the planting of flowers. There are a lot of special powers, many of which relate to the acquisition of and planting of flowers. And so if you're going to make a Euro game that's middleweight or higher and maintain some level of focus, that is very much my bias. And if you compare Windmill Valley to Barcelona, Danny Garcia's other major Euro offering, I do prefer Windmill Valley because it is more focused in terms of its scoring. And so there's that.
Windmill Valley.
Windmill Valley.
And those are the games we played this week. Now, a quick break to pay some bills.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter.
Walker, I should have reported it a couple weeks ago. It's already Chinese New Year.
It has started.
Yeah, so there's some debate as to whether we should be calling it Chinese New Year or Lunar New Year, but broadly speaking, the one that matters to us as board gamers is principally the one that occurs in China. And I first got my first, it's Chinese New Year notification in early December. It keeps getting sooner and sooner these years. Have you put up your Lunar New Year decorations yet?
Not yet.
Yeah. It's time. I love how there's this weird balance where in the Kickstarter updates, you find these publishers, a lot of them publishing for the first time because such is the way of crowdfunding. You're like, how much detail do we need to go into here? Because you need to write an update that is going to be read by somebody for whom this may be their first Kickstarter project. It could be their 100th Kickstarter project. It's tricky. Anyway. It's that time of the year, Walker.
I can tie this in because this is my news is a little bit about China as well. So it's a bit vague, but there's not a lot of news during the holidays, Mark.
Thrill to those Ontario Vowels listeners. Vague. This is vague news.
I love
Fortress. I say this without mockery, by the way.
Fortress America.
Fortress America.
There's an old Milton Bradley game called Fortress America. It's about all of the forces outside of America, including Canada, all attacking America at the same time.
I didn't know Canada was involved.
And yeah, I think there's people coming from the north.
It was part of their Battlemasters line?
So long. It was just after their Battlemasters line.
Oh, okay.
I don't think it is counted in. Could be. Don't want to say. Anyway, it's a fantastic game. It was reprinted by Fantasy Flight.
I haven't played it.
True. For its time. I do enjoy it. So I read a little bit about this. There's a game coming out called 2045. It is about China attacking Taiwan. And it's going to be coming out soon. But unfortunately, it's less about the actual attack. And it's more about the 10 days leading up before the attack. So it sounds as though there's going to be more sort of political intrigue, more stuff like that than the actual combat itself.
That sounds great.
It does a little bit. I'm not sure. It could be one of these things where I don't...
Well, look, it's a topic that needs to be handled with a deft hand, clearly, right? But that is true of all of these consim-type things. And the hobby, I think, is gradually waking up to the idea that any major historical event, whether it's contemporary or whether it's in the past, needs to be done with a fair level of sensitivity. But hey, it's an intriguing topic.
It's more like, you know, Fortress America is very sci-fi.
Oh, yeah. It's very tongue-in-cheek. It's like, what was that movie? Red something?
Red Dawn.
Red Dawn. I haven't seen it, but it's kind of the same vibe, right?
Yes, just so.
I've looked it up, Walker. This is instant fact-checking.
Oh,
this
good
is a
stuff.
Service we offer here at So Very Wrong About Games. The 1986 Milton Bradley game Fortress America was part of their Game Master series.
There you go.
Battle Masters was indeed a specific game published by Milton Bradley. That was the one where they had the incredibly large hex map. This was like Richard Borg before Richard Borg was Richard Borg. This was pre-Command and Colors. Card-based activation fantasy warfare. I believe it was a Games Workshop collaboration with plastic miniatures of cavalry and orcs and stuff.
So I had
it was a cannon and an ogre and stuff. Yeah, I had that game. I got it for Christmas.
Then they're reprinting that.
They are. They are reprinting that. That is also news. They're reprinting Battlemasters. Go play Command and Colors instead. Any version.
What else? There was a pirate game.
Yes, there was a pirate game.
Shogun.
There was Shogun. There was the pirate game.
Axe and Allies.
Was it part of the Game Master line? Apparently we're now doing a real-time fact-checking into the Game Master
Conquest.
Line.
Conquest was one of the other ones as well.
Okay.
The Roman one?
Conquest of the Empire?
Yep.
Oh, no, the earlier one.
The earlier one.
Yeah, the one that was redeveloped in Conquest. Oh, no, you're right. Axis and Allies was part of the Game Master series, as was Broadsides and Boarding Parties.
That's the pirate
that was
one,
the name of the pirate one.
I did own that for a while.
Samurai, what was it called? It wasn't called Samurai Sword. It was...
Shogun.
It was called Shogun, yes, which was republished not too long ago as Ikusa. And Conquest of the Empire was then re-implemented. Actually, no, Conquest of the Empire was already a re-implementation of a game called Six Caesars.
Oh, well, there you go.
Okay, we need to stop this.
And in the new one that came out by Griffin Games, they had all the parts in it that you could play both, which I thought was fantastic. Because the new one that they put out was a totally different game, but they made it so you could play the old Game Master series as well.
Yes,
so.
With a version, a sort of hatchet job of Martin Wallace's Struggle of Empires.
Yeah.
Into Conquest of it. It's a whole thing. Finally for me, this is long overdue news. I should have been talking about it earlier. Apologize for this. Is a game that has not yet been published, but it won the Zenobia Award. The Zenobia Award is for historical board game designs in the hobbyist space, highlighting undercovered historical events, frequently with design teams and or subject matter impacting people of color and marginalized communities. And the game that won the Zenobia Award this year, the second ever time, was The Porters by Lucas Coburn, Nico Coburn, and Alex Goss. This is about the Black Porters of Canada attempting to unionize in the train industry. And apparently there's a whole bunch of work-life balance stuff because it represents the struggle of having to, you know, still do your job while attempting to unionize, which sadly is a trenchant, evergreen struggle of a lot of people in the labor movement. And so this is available to play on Tabletop Simulator. It is not yet available in publication, but a lot of Zenobia Award shortlisters have now secured publishing deals. And I'm very, very much looking forward. The Zenobia Award is a fabulous award. It is a brilliant idea. It is a great source of support for a lot of upcoming designers. And I cannot wait to see more of the output. It is having a fabulous impact on the games industry, I think, especially in the context of historical hobby games. So that is The Porters, winner of the Zenobia Award by Lucas Coburn, Nico Coburn, and Alex Goss. I'm very much looking to play.
And that's the news, and why it sometimes matters. Now on to the topic of the week, which is a sheep in wolves' clothing. So games that on quick glance or quick preview look like it's going to play or play out completely different than the way it actually does.
Specifically in the sense that you're expecting a sort of throwdown, a rock'em sock'em military smackfest. And frequently what you get instead is, I think the most frequent thing you get instead is something more akin to a spreadsheet. Now, I'm not complaining. I love me a good spreadsheet now and then, but sometimes people react very badly in this context.
Yeah, that's what I'm, like, I have some quick negative, like maybe you're at a game store and you look at the back of the box and you say, oh my God, this looks great. And now you buy it and you bring it home. Or there's a pile of games on the table. It's like, you know, let's pick one that we're going to play.
Yeah.
And you say, oh, look, that's got something that looks very interesting. And then it gets set up and the rules go out and you're like, oh my God.
Well, or even after the rules go out, because, okay, so let's talk about I think the paradigmatic example of this style of game is Scythe.
Yes.
In the recent past, Scythe is perhaps the foremost example. And I know of a number of people, like the Handworker in particular says this, that it leads to a very bad first impression very often, because not only is it the case that people might have expectations that this game with large stompy mechs and pictures of large stompy mechs with like rotating blades and firearms and stuff, and then you deploy these big stompy things and almost never fight with them or never fight with them at all. Not only is it the case that it can lead to negative perceptions on that score, it can encourage people to play very badly. Right? Because if you've internalized this idea that this is going to be a game akin to Risk or some other troops on a map experience, and you just start throwing your military weight around all the time, that's just a route for failure. Like, it's not just not the way it was supposed to be played, but you're going to do badly, and you're going to grind to a halt, and you're not even going to be able to start the fights that you wanted to start.
This comes up a lot in Blood Rage as well, where you look at Blood Rage, and you see the troops, and you see these giant, you know, ogres, trolls, and giants and creatures, and you start, you know,
giant, badass, chained wolves.
Yes, you start invading, you think that's going to be this combat-type game, and it really is not.
Well, it can't. Okay, in defense of Blood Rage, it can be. I wouldn't necessarily put it in the same category as Scythe. In Scythe, there is no way, even if you're the faction that can do better with military conquest, namely the German faction, Black, you can do better with fighting with them. But you're still going to be getting an overwhelming majority of your points from non-fighty type stuff. And you're not going to be spending a lot of your time fighting. In Blood Rage, you can make a go of it kicking people's teeth in. It can be done.
Yeah, but it's not for the same reasons as you'd think. It's not to hold ground, or it's not to, you know what I mean? Usually are fighting for completely different reasons.
Maybe. Oh, well, no, but I still maintain. Look, okay. So there's the fact that somebody might be very disoriented by the fact that the person they beat in the combat might score more points from that loss than they will score from the victory. That, I will absolutely grant you, belongs in this category. But just saying because it's not because they're there to hold dirt, the same thing can be said for Kemet. Kemet is very much a smackdown troops on a map, we're going to be fighting all the time game. It doesn't belong in this category at all. But you seldom do that because you want to hold dirt. I will grant you that in Blood Rage you seldom want to hold dirt, but I don't think that is necessarily getting in the same space. I do agree with you that one way in which you have to approach Scythe and Blood Rage the same way is that the game has to be framed properly by the rules explainer so as to encourage a proper experience. For what it's worth, this is one of the primary reasons why I like talking about games of this ilk, because it's good to encourage people who are introducing these games or considering these games to have the proper framing in mind so as to be ready to enjoy them on their own terms.
Which is why I think we brought this topic up, is because we've been recently playing DEI, and that is fundamentally the start of the rules explanation.
Yeah.
You're going to see this looks like a troops on the map game. If you play that way, you will have a bad time.
Which I think actually leads to a specific observation that I have about DEI. I think, and this is seldom my reaction, this is definitely not my reaction to Scythe, this is not my reaction to Blood Rage, I think the AI could have done with a little more direct combat. Because, if you'll recall, one of my complaints was that the fascinating structure for victory conditions is often let down by how it actually shakes out by virtue of the existing victory conditions. So a couple of big examples is the one that says you get points for troops on the board at the end of the game. Well, there's very little that someone else could do to sap your reserves, because the ability to inflict casualties are so minimal in DEI that it's very difficult to stand in someone's way. There are the objectives that say you need to control various outposts. Those ones are great. You can fight over those. That's fine. But then there are ones you just need presence at various outposts. Ain't nothing anyone can do about that. And so it ends up making what should be a dynamic push and pull area majority contest too much into multiplayer solitaire, precisely by virtue of the fact that it could do with a little bit more fighting. That is my hot take on DEI.
All right, then there's games.
I stunned him into silence. He has nothing to say about that.
There's not much you can say. There are ways to take out troops. There is a drone that will kill one. So
absolutely,
it could
absolutely
pick off these.
I think a little bit more. Maybe if everybody had a core action card that had a kill on it, I think might have substantially improved the game.
And then, like you said, yeah, there are symbols on cards that you might not be able to tell. So maybe you don't know they kill people because you can't. They look so
right.
Similar to the other ones.
Yeah, it's true.
But anyway. So another example would be games that just by the overall look of them look like they're going to play totally different. Like, let's look at Hansa Teutonica or Bus. If you see that game laid out, you think it's going to be a pick-up and deliver type game.
Yeah.
And they are not. They play completely different than what they would normally look at, like if laid out on a table.
Yeah, so like Hansa Teutonica and Turn and Taxis, for example, were vaguely similar in terms of aesthetic, maybe even vaguely similar in terms of historical setting, and play out completely differently. Hansa Teutonica is absolutely a brutally confrontational experience, and very often people aren't ready for it. And I agree, framing is very important in that context so that people don't have a bad experience. It reminds me a little bit of how some people misidentify or are not ready for El Grande. I will never forget, I bring this up all the time, I will never forget the time we played El Grande and then one of the Louis said, "Hey, it's an okay game, I wish there were a little more player interaction." Like, what are you talking about? And what he meant was fighting, because that was the only kind of player interaction at the time that he was able to appreciate. It was like, but in a very real sense, we've been fighting the entire time.
Yeah.
Like, that time that we were dumping cubes in the Castillo, what do you think we were doing? Anyway.
And then one might see, if they ever saw Gloomhaven or Oathsworn set up, that, oh, here we go, another dungeon crawling, you know, swing sword fest. When not, it's a very different sort of deck and or hand manipulation type game that you're not, you know, fighting is part of it or moving around the map is part of it, but the most of it is controlling other parts of the game.
In a real way, it's about an efficiency engine and combo triggering in as much or more as it is about the traditional trappings of board game combat.
Mage Knight also falls into that as well, where it looks like it's this grand adventure game, but no, you are managing your deck.
Yes. That reminds me a little bit of a lot of Napoleonic games, because a lot of people, I do this too all the time, they get, I don't know if lazy is the right term, but they definitely get sort of blinders. Like, I will get my troops and I will smash them against the other troops. In many Napoleonic games, you cannot do that. And it is, in point of fact, far more about feints and weird maneuvers and cutting off supply lines and not really ones about huge battles. Broadly speaking, there's an observation that sometimes people make that if there's a broad-pitched battle, one or both of the commanders made a huge mistake in allowing this to happen. And I feel that that is definitely true of a lot of Napoleonic games. And this is true of Bonaparte of Marengo and Napoleon's Triumph, Rachel Simmons' 2 masterworks. So they're so counterintuitive as a result, even when compared to other consims. And, MML Holland's games often fall into that as well. Even the old-style Columbia block war game just called Napoleon about the Waterloo campaign, very similar. You may think that because you've got the superior force, you can just go and smash into people. No. You need to engage in a lot of dancing first. And that I find very counterintuitive, even when I know the historical setting a little bit more than I do from other games.
And there'd be games that you have no idea. Game is set up, or there's a picture of the game in the box. And there is no way, like Revive, if you see Revive set up at the table, That is like another, what is it called, Six Moon? What's the Annabelle Holland?
It's not as bad as Six Moons.
It's trying to figure out what is going to happen in this game. Like, you have your tableau where discs are moving and you can energize actions and this map where you're putting out stuff, but why? And
I will grant you that that is true of the incredibly superfluous Crystal Skulls. Superfluous in terms of visual and thematic idiom, not in terms of game mechanisms. But you're doing this thing about populating and getting technologies, and oh, by the way, there are these Crystal Skulls, and the game, to a comedic extent, fails to give any kind of context for what the heck these Crystal Skulls are.
Like, don't get me wrong, once the game is going, everything falls into place and Everything makes sense.
But, yeah, Revive is pretty cohesive.
But
yeah.
taking a look at the table presence for the first time, there is no way you're going to parse out what is about to happen.
Do you get the impression, though? This is a specific question. Do you get the impression from the setup of Revive that anyone might be under the impression that this is a sort of direct confrontational style game? I don't think so, but there are kind of hex spaces on a map.
And you have meeples and buildings, so you might think that
maybe. I don't know.
And there's aliens, so
silly Crystal Skull. Well, are they aliens?
Who knows?
I would have appreciated some degree of guidance about the Crystal Skulls. I apologize for getting hung up on the Crystal Skulls.
But it is so weird.
It is so incredibly bizarre. If anyone knows what that's about, please let me know.
That's not a hat. You might look at it in the brief explanation, think it's just a basic memory game. But when it starts to be played out, it is much, much more than that.
And when played well, it is played very aggressively. I'm convinced I'm never able to play this way. I'm far too nervous, and I'm just desperately trying to scrape together my three brain cells so that I can remember the two pieces of information that I need to remember. I'm not joking. That's often all that you need to be able to remember, and yet I'm completely unable to do it. It's a miracle. It's so weird. But the threshold at which someone starts bluffing so as to force someone to take points is way sooner than many people play it.
But you need two. That's the problem, is that you have to look across at the next player that's after that player. You got to make sure they're on the same page. There's got to be this shared vision.
Not necessarily.
Where we sort of like nudge towards that person and say, look, they've got their head down. I know you've got this card and I know I'm about to pass them something
else. I disagree. You can hang them both out to dry. You don't need the other person to be on the same page.
But someone's got
to
call them on it. You know, you tell them, oh, this is, you know.
It could be the next sucker down the line. Who's to say? It doesn't have to be the next person.
Oh, yeah, wait till it comes all the way down to front of you again. And
sure.
Maybe.
Someone's going to pay, so long as it's not you.
Yeah,
if you know what's going on, everything's fine.
It's true.
Then there are games. I just want to mention one more game in the same category as DEI that I wish it had a little bit more direct conflict, and that is Galactic Renaissance. Because whether you've played Inish or not, especially if you played Inish, you might be expecting, given the volume of rules about overstacking and the conflict system, that you might encounter more conflicts. I'm actually a little disappointed by how seldom they arrive. Because in Galactic Renaissance, they've already smoothed out the edges so that it's not like your entire round can be scuppered by a weird fight that you didn't start and had no part in but got dragged into in a weird way.
Yeah, because they sort of de-escalate kind of quickly and then they're done and then there's not much loss.
Yeah, it typically avoids the kind of mutual annihilation or incredible attrition that you might encounter occasionally on Inish. Some people love that part. That's fine. But they've already done that. And so I would have actually kind of appreciated it if in Galactic Renaissance it happened more often. That's partially a group problem. Absolutely. We are conflict averse in games where conflict is strictly optional. But I would have liked it if the game forced you into those kinds of situations a little more often. That is despite the fact that I like the game.
And lastly, for me, a little bit like Revive, I'm wondering about Food Chain Magnet, right?
Oh, yeah.
Seeing it sort of, and just not knowing how it's going to play.
Old-timey charm, lovely line art.
It's like, oh, we're going to run restaurants, and we're going to make pizzas and burgers.
I'm going to hire a waitress and steal her tips and ruin you financially forever.
And we're going to run ads so you'll sell nothing and steal all your customers.
Absolutely. There, at least, I'm a little bit less worried about the sort of Scythe effect, right? People, generally speaking, I'm convinced, have gone into Scythe not knowing what they were in for. I suspect if you're playing a smaller game, you know what you're getting into. But that's more a question of marketing and distribution than anything else. But I agree with you. It is absolutely a wolf in sheep's clothing. oh, so brutal. Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our relevant information on our website, sowronggames.com. We appreciate so, so much the fact that you have decided to spend some time with us, and we hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.